This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, July 5th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we are going to answer a listener email, and then we're going to talk about Ty West's newest movie, Maxine. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor, BJ Colangelo.
Hi, hi, hiya.
All right, BJ, at the very top of the show, I have to apologize to the listeners on, I think it was, whatever it was, Friday. On Wednesday's show, I mentioned in a conversation with Brad about the Beverly Hills Cop movies that Ronnie Cox died a couple years ago. That is wrong. Ronnie Cox is still alive. So I'm sorry to our listeners. I'm sorry to Ronnie Cox. The dude is awesome. I'm glad that he's still out there and kicking. So that was just my bad. Wanted to mention that right up top. Okay. Along similar lines, I wanted to mention we were talking about The Bear earlier this week. And I wanted to shout out Angelica from North Texas, who wrote us an email pointing out a fascinating connection between the movie Burnt and season 3 of The Bear. And without spoiling things, I can say that there's a moment in The Bear season 3 where Richie sees a fork on the floor of the restaurant. And if Angelica's theory is correct, it could have pretty big consequences from what might happen in season 4. And I wrote an article about that. I'm going to link to that in the show notes. So check that out. BJ, have you had a chance to catch up with all of The Bear season 3 yet?
Oh yeah, I'm finally caught up. It took me a little longer than usual because I wasn't as hot on this season as the ones prior, so it wasn't so much a priority. I was watching Shoresy season 3, if I'm going to be honest, because that is still the best show on Hulu and no one watches it, and that kills me. But I did finally finish it, and I read your piece as well, and I very much agree. I think there is a connection here.
All right. So yeah, definitely check that out. All right. So I'm going to get into another listener email, and I thought it would be fun to talk with you about it, BJ. Carissa from Wisconsin sent us this email last month, and I've been meaning to get around to it. I thought now would be a good time. So Carissa says, love the podcast, and I've been listening for years. Lately, I've been intrigued by the discussion between you and Ryan about the state of theaters. My husband and I started dating in a theater and always watched probably 2 to 3 movies a month in theaters before COVID. We love theaters so much that we had our wedding pictures in a new theater that was built in our town in 2015. However, COVID made us update our TV and sound system at home for watching movies. It also made us less tolerant of bad moviegoers. Talking with our friends, we all agree that we have a great theater. However, we cannot stand the people that go to movies. Movies for us have been ruined by cell phones. Even adults are using their phones and being obnoxious during the movie. Between cell phone light and just rude talking, we barely see movies in theaters anymore. We started sitting in the front 3 rows, but half the time we still see their lights because they're so bright. We get so annoyed with it, we're renting a theater for us and our friends to see Twisters in July. I can deal with whispering and occasional talking. I cannot deal with the constant cell phone use anymore. Do you think theaters could do anything about cell phones? I know that would bring a lot of people that I know back to theaters. So thank you for writing that in, Carissa. And I wanted to pose that question to you, BJ. That seems to be kind of like at the heart of a lot of conversations that we've been having, that this idea of sort of like this post-COVID period where like everybody's behavior has changed. And I mean, it was bad before the pandemic, but like so many things, it seems like bad behavior in movie theaters has kind of been accelerated because of the pandemic. So what do you do? And what is your experience like going to theaters? Are there a lot of people talking and using phones where you go, or what's the deal there for you?
Oh, I have so many thoughts and feelings. Like, this is when I turn into, like, big brain brainiac about this sort of thing. So I now live in Los Angeles, which means I have a variety of theaters to choose from. There are a lot of repertory theaters out here, places like the New Beverly Cinema, which is the one that Quentin Tarantino owns. There's also, like, Vidiot's, which is where I'm at all the time. And in theaters like that, cell phone usage tends to be kind of non-existent, with the exception of, like, if they're doing RRR and somebody is, you know, dancing to Nachu Nachu, people will record the person dancing, and that's a different sort of situation. Mm-hmm. But by and large, the rep screenings are people who are movie fans, and they are, like, diehard movie fans. They're not going to be dicking around on their phones, because they view movie theaters the same way that I do, as, like, holy spaces, so to speak.
Yeah, but so that's, like, a best case scenario.
That is the best case scenario. And then in those situations, the only thing I really have to deal with are people who are, like, super film snobs that think they're above every movie, so they laugh at things that are inappropriate because they're above it. Whatever, those people can suck eggs, I don't care. But then I also have giant megaplex theaters in one of the most populated cities in the world, which means that a lot of times, if I'm seeing something like opening weekend at, like, a giant AMC, I do have to deal with the absolute worst people on the planet. And it is so infuriating. And the way that I've navigated that is, I'm very lucky to live near, it's sort of like a thing out in LA. It's like there's three Burbank cinemas within, like, two blocks of each other. There's the 16, which is where they do a lot of press screenings. There's the 8, which, like, nobody really goes to. And then there's my favorite, which no one else likes, is the 6. But I like the 6 because it's underground. So cell phones don't work. So I don't have to worry about it. But I have no problem confronting people, but I'm also, you know, very privileged to live in a place where I don't have to worry about somebody pulling a gun on me for telling them to put their phone away. That's not always the instance, where depending on where people live. Also, I don't think that people in the audience should be required to kind of babysit or police people in the theater by telling them to put their phones away. Mm-hmm. That should be the job of, like, an usher, the way that it is with stage theater, where the ushers will tell you, put your damn phone away, and they'll kick you out or do whatever. That can't happen in a lot of movie theaters that we have, because everyone is underfunded. So it is a combination of, one, people being entitled and having short attention spans and just being, you know, just selfish and disrespectful to their fellow neighbor, but also capitalism ruining everything. You know, perfect storm. We love it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing, is, like, you know, maybe in an ideal scenario, there could be an employee, like, standing there and kind of, or maybe in the very back of the theater or something, like, just keeping an eye on things and making sure that the picture quality is up to par and all of that kind of stuff. And then, like you said, maybe being able to enforce some of the sort of loose rules that these theaters try to say, hey, you know, turn your phones off at the start of the movie or whatever, but, like, there's no enforcement. So it's really tough getting people to actually behave properly. And yeah, these theaters, like, a lot of them have been either in bankruptcy already or on the verge of bankruptcy, especially because of the pandemic. So, and then also, yeah, just, like, the hellscape of capitalism of, like, all right, we gotta, you know, make enough money for our investors for the next quarter or whatever. Like, they're cutting costs wherever possible. So yeah, it just kind of creates this perfect storm where, like, I feel like a lot of people feel exactly the way that Carissa does about this, where, like, especially because, I mean, we've been saying this for years, like, good high quality flat screen TVs or whatever are commonplace now and pretty cheap compared to what they used to be. So it's no wonder that a lot of people decide to just stay home. So, like, the fact that Carissa wrote this in now in 2023, or I'm sorry, 2024, basically makes me, like, it sends me into this existential spiral, because, like, if we're still having these issues and, you know, we haven't fixed this after all this time, like, I don't know if theaters are ever going to be able to do anything about this. Like, obviously the now Sony owned Alamo Drafthouse has kind of, like, built their entire existence mm-hmm. on being able to actually try to enforce this stuff and like make it a big part of the movie going experience to try to create that space for people. But for AMCs and Regals and whatever of the world, I just don't know if there is a way out of this. Do you see a way out, BJ?
Like, really, we just have to retrain people how to go to the movies and how to be in the movie theater. And the other thing that's, you know, compounding all of this is how quickly movies are being pulled from the theaters and put into, you know, VOD services. Because what ends up happening is a lot of people who are like, I'm not going out, you know, the first two weekends when it's packed because I don't want to deal with the world's worst people. I'm going to wait. Then they don't get to wait to see it because by the time it's, you know, filtered out and it's not packed all the time, the movies are on VOD. So at that point, why don't you just watch it at home? So it is a matter of like, we're going to have to retrain people that, you know, movie theaters are a place where you put your phone away. There was something that Slash Film writer Bill Bria had posted on, I think it was on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, that I have been haunted by for the last few months. But he was at a screening and it was like a preview screening. People could say they were there, but it was, you know, not open to the public. And the person next to him tweeted that they were at the movie and then spent the rest of the movie watching people react to them saying that they were at this movie early.
Oh, God.
And I was like, that's 100% it. That is exactly it. It is people taking pictures of, you know, whatever's on the screen, like the Evil Dead Rise title card was a big one, and then sitting on Instagram and TikTok and Twitter and watching people, you know, get all those likes and spike all that dopamine and, you know, make them all excited because they got to do something cool. Like, oh, look at all these people that are excited that I'm at the movies, and then you don't actually watch the movie. Yeah. It's maddening.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm sorry, Carissa. Like, this has been an issue that has been plaguing this industry for a long, long time. And I'm sorry that we don't have a better answer for you here. I think if we did, we would probably be a lot richer than we are. So this is I don't know if anybody else out there has any thoughts on this. I would love to hear them. If you have any potential solutions, I would love to hear them. We might be able to like get them in front of some people at AMC, or maybe ask somebody who works at a big theater chain, like what they're doing about this or whatever. So just shoot us an email. I'll give you the email address at the end of the episode. All right. I guess before we take a break, BJ, let's do some spoiler-free thoughts about Maxine. This is Ty West's new movie. It's the third movie in this trilogy. The trilogy began with a movie called X and then was followed up with a prequel called Pearl. I really, really loved Pearl. I liked X quite a bit, but I thought Mia Goth, who is the star of all of these movies, was like next level in Pearl. I know people have their favorites of this trilogy in terms of rankings and stuff. We don't really need to get into that now. But what was your, I guess, anticipation level going into Maxine? I assume you're a fan of the two previous movies.
Oh, through the roof is what my expectation was. I was very like, okay, I like X. There's a lot in X that I really, really like. Pearl, I was very, very into Pearl, continued to be very, very into Pearl. It is absolutely one of my favorite movies of the last decade. And Maxine was the one I was most excited for because I was already very much in on, you know, the Mia Goth just supremacy that we've been living in here. But I love this specific type of the 1980s. And I have to emphasize this specific type of the 1980s because I am not a super big fan of what I like to call the Stranger Thingsification of the 1980s that we've sort of been trapped in for the last 15 years. I don't like, don't get me wrong, I like Amblin, I like all of that stuff, I think it's very cute, but I am so tired of it. Like, I'm so sick of that type of 80s. What I'm not sick of seeing ever is sleazy 80s, the type of 80s of schlocky movies that everyone is convinced are bad, actually. Those are the movies that I love, and this is the world of the 1980s that Ty West is playing in, so I was very, very excited going into it.
So I have to say that I was extremely disappointed with Maxine. The trailer was unreal. It was like one of my most anticipated movies of the year because of how great that trailer was and because I was so hyped from Pearl. It got me super amped, but I found the movie itself to be kind of a slog. Like, there were elements of it that I appreciated, and we'll get to those in a couple minutes, but for the most part, I thought that this movie didn't really get going until way too late. And for a movie that has the unpredictability of Mia Goth at the center of it, I found it to be weirdly boring. But I'm guessing we're on opposite ends of the spectrum, because I know that you enjoyed the movie a lot more than I did. But what did you think about, I guess, the movie overall, and then specifically like the pacing of it?
See, the pacing of it, though, is like, this is just something that I'm very, very familiar with. It has such a similar pacing to movies like Robert Vincent O'Neill's Angel, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, and Cat Shea's Stripped to Kill. There's also a little bit of Gary Sherman's Vice Squad, which is also written by Robert Vincent O'Neill in there. But like, people keep pointing out like, oh, De Palma, oh, Giallo films, like Argento films. And I don't like, yes, they're there, but really, this is like low budget, micro budget, you know, horror cinema that, you know, played at midnight on Cinemax at 2 a.m, like whatever. Mm-hmm. Like those are the types of movies that it's chasing. And those movies all have really weird pacing. All of those movies have kind of like an oops, all choices mentality behind them. So it really worked for me because I'm primed for this sort of thing. And these are movies that I actively like because it just, I don't know, it just speaks to me. I like these movies because they very much feel like they're exposing a world that I'm not supposed to be looking at. It that they are exploring characters that live lives that the newspapers want me to think are dangerous or taboo, and instead they get to be the focus. Mm-hmm. And because all of those movies are all so strange, where it's like there'll be something that is like one of the most deeply twisted and wild things you've ever seen, followed by like borderline slapstick buddy cop comedy, I was like, oh no, this is everything that I wanted. Like he figured out that formula, which is such a hard one to match. It's very similar to when I was talking about Lisa Frankenstein earlier this year, which is a horror comedy that a lot of people didn't like. And I was like, well, it's because the comedy isn't like comedy by way of like John Hughes comedy. It's comedy by way of like Better Off Dead wackadoo absurdism comedy. And mm-hmm. so this is a very specific type of pacing that I like. And I know Ty West hates this term, but like Ty West, I think, is like a master of slow burn horror, as we've seen with like House of the Devil, where he is constantly dropping little teeny tiny bits of things that where you might think like, oh, nothing's happening, or oh, this is boring. And like all of it is leading towards something. You just have to be able to find it. So like this movie's a treasure hunt, and I love it. I just love it. I can't help it.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the movies that you mentioned in terms of the ones that he was referencing here. So mm-hmm. like you and I are just coming at this from like fundamentally hugely different places. So I wonder, I'm so curious like how this movie would play for me if I had that same foundation of references that you have to sort of compare and contrast this to. But yeah, I mean, all I can say is like, just for me not having that that foundation in place, I found this movie to be really, really lacking in some ways. And there are aspects that I liked about it. So we'll talk about those. Actually, let's go ahead and talk about those right now. So we'll take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details. Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
All right, so I thought there's some fun stuff in here aesthetically. I'm always a sucker for movies that take place on studio backlots, and I loved how much of this movie is like characters running around on, you know, clearly what is like the Warner Brothers lot and the Universal lot and all this stuff. And like actually having lived in LA and been on a lot of those lots and worked on the Paramount lot and all of that, I have like an inside knowledge of like when these characters are in a chase scene and they're running from one building to another, they're actually cutting between different studio lots and it's all designed to look like one big one or whatever. So I loved all of that kind of stuff. That's very like super nerdy. Not very many people are actually going to get that level of enjoyment out of it. But I loved that part of it. What did you think about like the glamorous side of Hollywood versus like the underbelly side of it?
Oh, I love it so much. And in my review for it, I pointed out that that is something that I love, like, very deeply, because the 1980s as a decade, you know, I think we're far enough removed now that people like to pick and choose what they remember about the decade to kind of fulfill their memory and like their nostalgia of it. When like the 80s is such a decade of like contradictions, because we'll talk about like, oh, the excess and the glamour and look at all these like fun neon colors. Meanwhile, war on drugs, AIDS, like there's a lot of bad shit happening in the 80s at the same time. And so that this movie is doing that constantly, where it's like, here is the glory of the Hollywood studio lot, and this is where big, important art is made. Also, where Scooby-Doo style chase scenes can happen, where Kevin Bacon is running like a madman. Like, that I think is so wonderful. And like the same thing is like, you know, the streets of Hollywood, where it's gritty and dirty and filthy and people are dying. And it's like, yeah, but it's also where every single person wants to go. You don't come visit Hollywood and not go to the Strip. You have to. And so like that stuff I find really, really interesting. And I love that it's jumping between different sort of studio lots, because it continues to paint this brush of the fantasy of Hollywood, of this idea that we have in our head of what it's actually like. And it's all manufactured to the point where even running between, you know, different studio lots, like it's manufactured, like, it's chef's kiss.
Yeah, totally. And like even the idea of being a star, which is like the driving force between or behind Maxine as a character, is a manufactured idea. Like I'm reading this book now that I'll talk about later on the podcast when I finish it. But it's called The Oral History of Hollywood. And it's talking about, it covers everything, like the original silent days, like all the way through to now. And they're talking about the section that I'm in right now is about like the MGM lot back in like the 30s and 40s, and like how controlled movie stars' lives were, and like publicity departments and movie magazines and like everything, where like they basically went through training given to them by the studio to be these public personas. So like a lot of the stuff is not just I roll off the bus from Iowa and I'm discovered and now I'm suddenly a movie star. There's like an entire organization that goes into creating something like that. And I think in a subtle way that this movie and like that sort of contributing to the dream factory element of it that you're talking about is like kind of continuing on that legacy in a way, and sort of almost like calling back to not just these references of the movies that you mentioned before, but kind of like the idea of Hollywood in general. So
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's even literal in some instances. Like, well, one, the cult of personality thing, that's just because everything is wrestling. But I've said that many times on this podcast. Everything is wrestling. But we even get that towards the very beginning, where one of the big, like, oh shit set pieces is Maxine being confronted by somebody in an alley who wants to attack her, and she literally stomps his balls out. He's a Buster Keaton, like, sideshow, like street performer. She's literally killing Buster Keaton in this moment. And like, if that is not what the sleazy new era of Hollywood was doing to like golden age cinema, I don't know what else is. Like, I don't know how much clearer this metaphor needs to be.
Yeah. I liked a lot of that visual stuff. There's this head cast scene that I liked too, where Maxine basically has this panic attack. I like it because it works on a couple different levels for me. Like, it seems to imply that as soon as she sits still, her ideas in her head get really loud, and like the past catches up to her. And that's a very disturbing thought for her to have, like the horrible things that she's done in her past and these experiences that she's had. It kind of implies that she's like a shark and she's always moving forward and she's driven so much, you know, with these desires to like further herself and her career and become a star and all this. And if she stops for a second, the horror of all of this stuff could catch up to her. So I liked all of that. And then also I think as she sits there with all that goop dripping on her face, it kind of feels like the movie starts to be in conversation more with some of the themes of the previous two movies, which I appreciated, like especially like how people treat women and like what women have to do to be movie stars, and like the aging thing too, especially with Pearl and like, or I guess the Pearl character in X. So I thought the visuals and all of that kind of like, culminated in the scene where I was like, oh, okay, this is what I want the movie to be. But for me, it was just like, oh, this was kind of a blip in otherwise a movie that I wasn't really engaged with. But what did you make of that whole head cast scene?
Oh, that scene like gave me a mild panic attack because I've had a head cast done and it is like very stressful if you're not really calm and prepared for it, because you do kind of feel like you're suffocating a little bit, even though like there's air holes, but losing all of your senses at once is very scary. And especially that like Sophie Thatcher's character leaves the room. Absolutely not. No way. Like, you need to stay here and talk at me or I'm going to think I'm going to die.
Yeah. And she didn't even have like a spoon or straws up in her nose. Like no. I've seen so many people do. So yeah, I was like, oh, I was really feeling for her in that moment.
Yeah. It's terrifying, but I love that scene because I agree with you. It is like, she's a shark. If she stops moving, she'll die kind of thing. But also when she's covered in the goop, everything is starting to like drip down. Word like that is the most like Pearl warns you, like, one day you're also gonna be like this, you're also gonna be old and irrelevant and gross, and like that's kind of what she's experiencing in this moment. So not only is it the past catching up with her, it's also a look at the future of what is going to happen to her and how like she's got to strike now or Pearl's gonna be right. And yeah, like that I think is like, it's just fascinating and such a strong theme throughout this.
Yeah, totally. The story felt like it was building to a reveal that I thought was pretty obviously telegraphed from the opening frame, which left me feeling impatient for a lot of the movie, kind of waiting for them to either subvert my expectations, which did not happen, or like lean into this looming confrontation. But because the confrontation comes so late in this movie, I'm talking about obviously between Maxine and her father, who is like the killer figure that has been claiming lives throughout the film. I felt myself spending most of the story just kind of like disengaged from what was going on. But I did like the confrontation under the Hollywood sign between Maxine and her dad at the very end of the movie. So I was wondering what you thought about how the movie sort of parceled out that information and then what you thought about like the actual culmination of it there.
So I think that people would like this movie so much more if the opening scene wasn't there. The cold open of Maxine as a child doing the Pearl audition dance, which I thought was a cute touch. And the reminder of like, oh yeah, Maxine is the daughter of this, you know, religious televangelist borderline cult leader. I think if had that scene not been there, it wouldn't have been nearly as obvious that her father is the one who is actually killing the people close to her, trying to get close to her. But I do still really, really love that reveal because it reminds me so much of like, I don't know if you're familiar with like Ernst Perkel, but he was this crazed televangelist religious figure in the 60s, 70s, and 80s who straight up made like scared straight Christian propaganda exploitation films.
No, I've never heard of this person.
Yeah, so Nicholas Winding Refn released like a box set restoring a lot of this guy's like movies. They're nuts. And so this character is clearly like an echo of this guy. So to see the reveal of like, not only is he this weird religious loser, but also that he's making movies and making exploitation films and has constantly been documenting these things, like everything kind of falls into line for me where I'm like, oh, this is great because he's a charlatan and he always was a charlatan, and calling that out for what it is, I think this is a really smart way to do that. But also it makes so much sense about like why Maxine is the way she is, because her father can act as if he's trying to be this religious person and saving people. No, he's not. He wants to be famous too. This is just the route he's taken. Yeah, and so like, I love all of that confrontation, especially when he's like taking cues to call action and then jumping into his nonsense. I was like, oh God, this is great. But yeah, the final showdown under the Hollywood sign is like beautiful. It's poetic. It's wonderful. I like just watch Blowout because I watch it every 4th of July, even though that's not a 4th of July movie, but whatever, because I love the shot of John Travolta under the fireworks. And like, this gives me that same feeling of like seeing her with a gun under the Hollywood sign with a helicopter light, like, oh, beautiful.
Yeah. I just really liked that because it kind of like it made the situation a little bit more complicated than just good guys, bad guys. This dad who clearly like messed up his daughter in a pretty significant way. Like the idea that her destruction of her own father is the thing that kind of gets her to become the star that she's always wanted to be. Like the decision that she makes to blow his head off with that shotgun, like under the lights of this helicopter, and like become this kind of public figure before she's able to then, people don't really notice her yet, except for her work in porn, right? Like she hasn't even starred in Puritan 2 yet. The production has not gone on yet while all of this insanity is happening. But she becomes this public figure on the heels of the Night Stalker being apprehended by regular citizens of LA. She becomes that type of figure. Like she's on the news circuit or whatever. And like the way that she was able to sort of like take her own destiny into her own hands, even if it means like, I have to literally kill my own father to do this. There was just like a lot there for me to chew on that I appreciated. And I was like, oh, finally, this movie is giving me something that I can really latch on to. Whereas I just kind of thought for the most part, as the movie was going on, it just felt like a lot of like very, very slow buildup to get to this moment. And I don't think that confrontation for me personally was enough to justify everything else that I sat through watching it, you know, but finally I was like, oh, finally a really, really good, enjoyable scene in this film. So, I just wanted to shout that out. I kind of thought the kills throughout this movie were pretty uninspired, and that's when there are any kills at all, which this movie is like surprisingly light on. So I wondered what you thought about that aspect of it.
Yeah. So this is one that, because it's dealing with so many different genres that it's working with, because I mean, we have the LAPD, they are a buddy cop comedy, like straight up, that's what's going on in their world. Then you do have a little bit of this like giallo element, but I will say, I think I wrote about this in my review, and I may have not, but the giallo elements feel less giallo and more like the slasher movie from 1981 called Night School, which is a slasher movie that is like clearly inspired by giallo, but is not a giallo film. It felt more in line with that movie for me, which a lot of that is stuff that you see off screen with the occasional like big money kill, which is, I think, what we get with, you know, Kevin Bacon getting crushed in a car crusher. With Giancarlo Esposito in that wig. That wig deserves all the awards. It's incredible. It's so awful and wonderful at the same time. So you have like moments like that. But this movie is so... How do I explain this in a way? So this movie to me doesn't have nearly as much sex in it, despite it being about somebody who works in sex. It doesn't have as many kills in it, despite it being marketed as like a horror movie or a slasher. And that to me makes total sense, because Maxine doesn't need that anymore. Like in X, sex was a way for her to get ahead. She did it because she wanted to be famous, and that was the route she took. Well, now she's got this new legit role that she's been cast in. She doesn't need the sex anymore, so therefore we don't need it anymore. But even though we don't see it, she is constantly defined by it. And the same thing with the kills. Even though we don't see a lot of kills in this movie, Maxine Minx is constantly defined by the fact that she has killed people, and that there are people dying around her. And so to me, like, I think that is a really interesting layer, but it's one that I know a lot of people are not going to be down with. And that's, I think, fine. Like the thing I've really loved about this, and with, I guess, this trilogy in general, is how I know just as many people who are like, Maxine's the worst in the series, as I do Maxine is the best in the series. And that to me is like, that is the sign of a good trilogy, because in a lot of these horror franchises, there's usually like one or two that everyone agrees is the good ones, and then everything else is Halloween 5. but in this trilogy, everybody has like there's no universal belief of which one is the best one. And that is very cool to me.
Yeah, that does seem super rare. And I've seen that, just anecdotally in our own Slack with a handful of people, you know, providing their rankings and stuff. It seems like it's kind of all over the place. So like, I guess you got to love that when that happens, because it just means there's more interesting conversations being had about everything. So
totally.
Okay, well, any other aspects of this movie that you wanted to shout out or highlight or say that you loved or didn't like or anything like that? I think I've run out of everything that I took notes about, but
I love Elizabeth Debicki so much. I love that this is a movie that lets her be tall because she is 6'3", and this movie lets her be 6'3". She's not being apple-boxed around with her co-stars because a lot of people don't know this. Mia Goth is 5'10". Like, she's not short. So I love seeing the two of them together. And it's like, oh, they let you both be tall. What a great day this is.
There was a moment near the end where Elizabeth Debicki is wearing these like this gigantic 80s jacket with like the shoulder pads and everything, and I was like, this jacket is like half as long as her body is tall. This jacket is insane. So yeah, just the proportions of her wearing that costume really stood out to me visually. So
yeah, I just also love her character so much, because I think there's like two things happening at the same time. Is that one, she's constantly like just so done with the system. She's like, they're scared of my voice, I'm making art, I'm doing all these things, and we know she's working on like a schlocky sequel to a horror movie. So like that I think is just incredible. But also like I would watch anything that director makes because I do believe that she probably has a really interesting voice that is being stifled by the studio system.
Yeah.
And I love that. But ultimately I wrote a piece that came out today about Maxine's relationship with horror and adult film stars, and how horror tends to be the genre that is okay with casting people who were once porn stars in ways that other genres just don't, with the exception of like comedy. But then are you really casting them because you believe in their talent, or are you doing it because porn star? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I put in there is like, I like to believe that like Maxine's casting is gonna like change the studio system, and people are gonna think she's so talented in The Puritan 2 that they're gonna be more willing to take risks on porn actors. But we know that that's not true. And ultimately, like, the ending of Maxine, I don't think that it's like positive. I know a lot of people are like, oh, she did it, she's a star. But it's like, okay, yeah, but what happens next? We know so many women who get to star in a really cool horror movie in the 80s and then do nothing else for the rest of their career. And so that is like the thing in the back of my mind is like, she finally got what she wanted, but like, how long is that going to last? Is she going to be on the convention circuit in 20 years signing autographs and taking pictures from the one movie she did? Like, we don't know these things.
Yeah, like I definitely had that feeling at the very end, because I think the last line of the movie is somebody asking her what she wants now that she's achieved this dream. And she just says like something along the lines of like, I want it to continue forever, basically. And like, that's such an unrealistic goal that you know that that's not going to happen. And then like the camera sort of like flies out of the stage and shows that Maxine has replaced the Hollywood sign. And it's just like this visual idea of like her having reached this pinnacle of this dream that she wanted. But yeah, I think there's like a sense of maybe not melancholy, but like something akin to that almost, where it's like, well, she's reached the apex and there's no going up from here. Like it's all downhill from here, basically. There's no way she's going to be able to actually sustain this as a real thing that she desperately wants so bad. It's just not going to happen. And I feel like there's like a tiny hint of the movie sort of acknowledging that, but kind of leaving on like what is ostensibly a positive note, but I think there's a sense of sadness there that sort of is lurking underneath.
And I think there is a little bit of metacasting in having the one person who is like truly her foe in this movie is Kevin Bacon, who is one of the very few people who have been able to do that, who have been able to start out in a horror movie and become a superstar and maintain that superstardom. Obviously, he's had like peaks and valleys, as everyone's career does, but he's still making movies today. He's like this beloved figure. And for her to be up against him and then ultimately like squash him down, I was like, ooh, there's like an extra layer here if you really sit and think about it.
Yeah, honestly, didn't even think about that, but that actually makes me like the movie more. So
see, that's my goal. My goal is never to like convince people to join my side. My goal is to make people see movies in ways that they wouldn't have otherwise. Like, that is all I ever want to do.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you've accomplished your mission here today, PJ. So I would love to know what other people, our listeners, think about Maxine and this trilogy. And then also if they have any thoughts about Carissa's email from earlier, you can email us. You can send feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Don't forget to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. So that's going to do it for today's show. You can find much more about Pearl and X and Maxine at slashfilm.com. I will try to link to a couple things in the show notes, including our review of Maxine. Slash Film Daily is typically published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details. Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.